It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Lynn Povich has had a distinguished career in journalism, and now she's bringing her experience and expertise to Iowa as the Mary Louise Smith Chair in Women in Politics at Iowa State University. She was the first female senior editor at Newsweek magazine, former editor-in-chief of Working Woman magazine, and also the East Coast managing editor at MSNBC.com. She's the author of the book The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace, a book that inspired a series that's now streaming on Amazon Prime called Good Girls Revolt. And here's a moment from the premiere as the new girl on staff learns how the office works.
They're reporters, we're researchers. We report, investigate, and write files for the reporters. They do a pass on them, put their names on them, and then the stories go to press.
And there it is in a nutshell. The book and the series follow the action in the Newsweek newsroom where women were fighting for equality. In 1970, Lynn Povich was one of 46 women who filed sex discrimination charges against the magazine. And she is here with me now. Hello, Lynn.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And for people who aren't familiar with the story, I know you've told it a million times, but before those sex discrimination charges were filed against Newsweek, what was the setup? As we heard in the intro, women were researchers, men were writers, and there was no crossing that line?
That's right. Newsweek, like Time, hired men as reporters, writers, and editors, and only women as researchers or fact checkers. So even though some of us graduated from the same schools or worked on our college newspapers, and we had an incident where two people graduated from Columbia Journalism School as graduates, he got to be the writer, she became the researcher, and that's just the way it was.
What made this movement begin? What was the catalyst that got the women at Newsweek talking to each other about really possibly affecting change?
One of the researchers, Judy Gingold, who was a Phi Beta Kappa from Smith and a Marshall Scholar at Oxford, came back to be a fact checker at Newsweek and had a conversation with a friend who was a lawyer. And when she explained the system at Newsweek, the woman said, "You know, that's illegal." And Judy didn't believe her and called the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in Washington, and the woman at the other end of the line said, "Yes, it's illegal to segregate jobs by gender." And when Judy realized that and came back and told several of us at the magazine, that really galvanized us to say, "Oh my gosh, it's not just unfair, it's actually illegal." And that's when we started to organize.
And do you remember when you first got brought in that conversation?
I did. I was the fifth person to be brought in because we were trying to figure out, once we realized that we had to do something morally, how to do it while we were still working at Newsweek and not get fired. Because once you file a complaint, you're protected from being fired. But before you file, if they found out that we were organizing at the magazine while we were working there, we were terrified that we could all be fired and thought we probably would be. So we decided that each of us knew other women we trusted, and we decided to organize by each of us taking one other person who would then take one other woman that they trusted. And when we got to be about 10 or 12, we started looking for a woman lawyer to represent us.
And you found an extraordinary woman lawyer to represent you.
We did. We went to the ACLU in Washington and in New York, and we found the assistant legal director, who was a young woman named Eleanor Holmes Norton, who is now the delegate from the city of Washington to Congress.
One of the things that makes this story so interesting, and when I think about you reaching out and finding women that you trusted, is that not only were women and men segregated in their work roles at Newsweek, but there were a lot of romantic relationships that were taking place, and actually within the staff, but within the building as well, which created an environment where it must have been hard to know who to trust.
Well, it was. And in fact, there were two women that we didn't approach initially because they were dating either writers or top editors, both of whom ended up marrying those men. And we were afraid that if they told them, it would leak out. And So one of them we ultimately told, and she joined us, and we trusted her. The other one we actually never told, and she ended up marrying this top editor because it was just much too close to real management.
The book, when you published it, received a lot of attention. The story is inspiring, frustrating, but also I can imagine that people immediately thought, ooh, this would make a great TV series or a great movie, but you were pretty reluctant to go in that direction. Why is that?
Well, I was. I did get a lot of interest from TV and film, but my lawyer told me that I would have no creative control, which is true for most projects these days. The studios have all the creative control. So the fact that it was me and my friends, I just was very reluctant to sell the option, because I just knew that, you know, television has certain demands. You know, they over-dramatize, they ramp things up, there would be a lot of sex, and I just was reluctant. And finally, one of the women who is a very successful producer in Hollywood, Linda Obst, called me about a year later. And I knew Linda because she was a journalist at the New York Times Sunday Magazine when I was at Newsweek. And so she was my age. She'd been a journalist. She was a very successful producer. She produced Nora Ephron's Sleepless in Seattle and Interstellar a few years ago. So I knew she could get it done, and I trusted her. And I sold it to her on the basis that it be fictionalized so that they could create the kinds of characters they wanted to, but that they would follow the arc of our story.
So what do you think of the series?
Well, I think, you know, it's not us as characters, but I think that they got the spirit of the story, the sense of the excitement of working in a newsroom, the sense of the times, what the late 60s and early 70s was like, and sort of what was going on around the country and all the sort of turbulence that was happening. And I think it's very good. I think what's interesting to me is the reason I decided to sell the option to Sony, who then sold it to Amazon, was that I wanted the story to reach a larger but also younger audience. And, you know, you write a book, it's great, but when you're on any kind of a streaming video, you get a younger audience. And I'm finding that it's young women in particular who are very excited by this series.
Well, and let's talk about watching this series, learning about this story at this moment in time. And, of course, during the presidential election, gender equality was something that we heard a lot about, the wage gap and, you know, child care and all kinds of issues that are very important to women today. Putting this story out there at this moment, what do you want people to take away from looking back to 1970?
Well, I've always felt the story of Newsweek really had two lessons. The first was that we banded together. We were sort of competing against one another, the researchers, for maybe the one person who might get promoted to be a reporter or be a writer. And it was by understanding that it wasn't us we should be fighting against. It was the system which was discriminating against us. And so for the first time, it was a rather radicalizing act for many of us to kind of come together and become a sisterhood, which was very much part of the women's movement ethos at the time, and very encouraging and supportive of women to come together and realize that the outside system, society, culture, families, had assumed certain roles for women which we just didn't want to do anymore. So that was the first lesson, which is that when you come together, when you organize, when you document the discrimination, you can actually make change. And I think the other lesson from Newsweek is that we loved working at Newsweek. It's a great place to work. We just wanted to make it better for women. And I think people will take away the fact that you can change the system from within. It's important to have the outside pressure of the rabble-rousers and the revolutionaries, but you yourself know the people, the levers of power, the system in your own workplace, organization, university, wherever you are, and you know how to make the change more effectively. So that's really what we did.
Do you feel like that idea of a sisterhood of people working together for the greater good and women working together for the greater good when it comes to gender equality, do you feel like that's something that's been lost?
Well, I do think that young women didn't have the role models of social protest that we had going through the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and then the women's movement. We knew how to organize and go into the streets and make our voices heard. I think the younger generation today is very good at that on the web, and they've made some important changes in the sort of kind of sexism that exists on internet sites and things like that. But I think they haven't figured out how to do it in person yet. They're just beginning to. I think many people, many young women have been galvanized by this campaign to come together and try to figure out how to do that.
I mentioned earlier that you are the 2016 Mary Louise Smith Chair in Women in Politics at Iowa State University. You'll be speaking tonight at 7 p.m. at the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. And you'll be talking about your story, but also many, many other things. And when you accepted this gig, I guess, when you knew that you'd be coming to Iowa State and be working with as the Mary Louise Smith Chair, things looked like we were probably going to have the first woman president of the United States. And now the world looks pretty different. How does that change your mindset in this role?
Well, I think for many of us who are hoping to have the first woman president, you know, we are very disappointed. But there are lots of things to be done. And I'm hoping that the more we talk about the issues that were raised in the campaign, the more we get together and figure out effective ways to organize and to make our voices heard, the better. And so I'm very honored to accept this invitation to come to Iowa State University and take this wonderful lecture chair that so many distinguished people have done before. And I'm really looking forward to it, to having a good conversation.
There are a lot of people saying that, oh, this election proved that we're not ready for a woman president. The United States isn't ready for that. And of course, there are many, many, many different elements to the presidential campaign and the election that were not about gender. What's your feeling? Do you feel like we're not ready for a woman president?
Well, it's very hard to say that. I think that there was certainly a lot of sexism in the campaign. I never thought it would be harder to elect a woman than it would be to elect a black. But obviously, Barack Obama proved me wrong. And I think that people are now understanding that there is still a lot of sexism that people are threatened by, certain kind of perhaps powerful, ambitious women. There were clearly other issues here as well, and it was a particular woman who ran who always seemed to engender a lot of hatred, even the last time she ran. So it's a combination of the particular person, but the kind of sexism which we saw, really overt sexism, which we hadn't seen in many, many years. Most of the sexism recently, whether it's at work or personal, has been much more subtle, and this was just very overt, and I think that has shocked a lot of people.
Do you feel like it is something that was allowed to be expressed because of the presidential campaign, or do you feel like it was something that was there all along? Was this an eye-opener that maybe there's a lot more sexism than people originally thought?
I think that's true, and I think that because it had become much more subtle, every organization has non-discriminatory policies, so it's much harder to determine whether something's really discriminatory or not, because it tends to be subjective judgments about hiring and promotion. But in this campaign, we saw overt expressions of misogyny, racism, sexism, and I think that's what certainly has galvanized a younger generation who may have felt that they were post-feminist, whatever that meant, or that was then and it's not true now. So I think it has had a real effect on younger generations. You know, mostly women are doing well in college. It's when they get into the workforce for after a few years that they begin to see obstacles in front of them. And so that's the age, you know, late 20s, early 30s, where women began to wake up to see, you know, what the barriers are to them.
So what is your message to college students right now as you go to Iowa State and as you mentioned earlier, sending out the series on Amazon Prime, Good Girls Revolt, is an opportunity to tell a story to a younger generation, a younger audience. So, you know, for girls who've grown up in a fairly privileged environment, they may not have felt like they have come face to face with gender discrimination and they are experiencing academic success. They may not have a reason to feel like they need to fight for gender equality. What is your message to them?
Well, what's interesting to me is there have actually been a lot of college issues that have woken up women at college, whether it's sexual assault on campus or, you know, certain ways of talking about women in the classroom or out of the classroom. And so a lot of people, you know, whether it's LGBT issues, a lot of people have sort of organized around their own issues in college. So they're beginning to sort of understand how to organize and think about protests, social protests, civil protest. But I think the point of the Good Girls Revolt is that I hope it will inspire everybody, men and women, and I have a lot of confidence in young men these days who've been raised by working women and who want to be involved in raising their children as well, that they will see that it's important to call out discrimination on anybody and that they can organize and change the system from within or from without. It's possible.
Lynn Povich, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Charity. Great to be with you.
Lynn Povich, she is the author of The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. She is also the 2016 Mary Louise Smith Chair in Women in Politics at Iowa State University. She'll be speaking tonight in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union at 7 p.m. The lecture is free and open to the public. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.